Donald Talks Tech, episode number 27, the first Black Magic feature. Donald.
It's Donald Talks Tech with James DeRuvo.
Never touch another man's butt.
Online at DonaldNews.com.
This time on Donald Talks Technology, I have the singular distinction of talking to the two filmmakers who were the first to use the Blackmagic Pocket Cinema Camera for a feature film. I'm talking with Mark LaFleur and Devin Lawrence of Chicken Bear Productions and their new film, Sympathy Said the Shark. And also, both work on the Travel Channel series Ghost Adventures.
Devin.
Yeah. Devin works on Ghost Adventures, right. And Mark LaFleur, you are a director of photography of one of my all-time favorite reality shows, Ace of Cakes.
Wow.
Yeah,
great.
Loved that show. Loved that show.
Yeah, it was fun. Fun show to make.
Devin, Mark, thanks for joining us on Donald Talks Technology.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, and you also have the singular distinction of being the first conference call interview that I've done via Skype. So this ought to be an interesting experiment. So I wanted to talk to you guys to talk about why you chose the Blackmagic Pocket Cinema Camera to use as a feature film. But I also wanted to start off at the very beginning. I usually take people through why you got into this business in the first place, because heaven knows it's not the easiest business to be in. So I'll start with Devin. Devin, why'd you get into filmmaking?
It's been, I guess, the goal, the dream for almost as long as I remember, you know, back from, you know, first making spoofs of Home Alone and Rambo with my brother when I was 12. And
you guys are part of that. You guys are part of that video camera generation, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
You grew up with video cameras and computers.
But no. I grew up with a VHS camcorder.
Yeah.
So we didn't have nonlinear editing until I got to college. At Mark and I both went to Emerson College in Boston.
Emerson College in Boston. Yeah. So is that where you guys met?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, Mark, what about you? How did your cinematic journey start?
I think my first project, I was asked to do a very scary project in a history class that was a paper I really didn't want to write. And a group of friends of mine, same as Devin, one of their dads had a VHS camcorder, and we decided to do a video project instead. All in camera edits, so you know, no pressure, get the take right, press stop, and then just keep recording and then rewinding back until you get a take you like. So the whole thing was cut in camera, but the project came together amazing. Our teacher was blown away, and I realized that this was something that maybe I didn't fully understand, but I really, really enjoyed the process of. And went out to LA, got to discover that there's quite a lot of amazing jobs in the business, and it had some great opportunities to make films with Devin, all kinds of projects. We actually made my first film on actual film, 16mm film, with Devin. A project, our very first project was together, and
was that Sacrificial Youth?
No, that was Dodgeball.
Dodgeball.
It was called Dodgeball. It was black and white, 16mm reversal film, a metaphysical throwback 80s gym class movie.
Dodgeball as a kid. That good times.
Yeah. We all did. Yep.
So,
but yeah.
So I have to ask you, Mark, you also worked on Honey Boo Boo.
Yeah.
Did you need therapy after that?
I didn't. My involvement was, it was short. There's crews that have to live in McIntyre, Georgia for months and months and months and months on end and live very intimately with the family. My job, the company I work for, Authentic Entertainment, I kind of set up the visual style for most of their new shows. And we actually, for that show, we shoot all of their family interviews in another location, another house, which somehow no one seems to talk about or recognize. I guess we did our job good, but everything, we have a whole other house where all interviews are set up. So it's a permanently built staged house with lights permanently built into it. It's just for sit down interviews. And I just went out there to kind of set up the whole look of all that kind of thing. So hence the consulting director credit. So I have to pop in once in a while just to tweak some things, help out. But the true genius of that project is handled by some other very talented folks.
Okay, so let's talk about you guys are obviously deeply embedded in this whole realm of reality television. And
yep.
What a lot of people don't realize is reality television is far from reality. But you guys have kind of been all over the reality map, from Discovery Channel to Bravo to Food Network to the Travel Channel, where you currently are, where Devin, you're doing Ghost, you're the editor for Ghost Adventures. So mm-hmm. let's briefly talk about the whole workflow of what of for those who might be interested in getting into the realm of reality television. You guys shoot a lot of footage.
Yes.
Like a lot of footage.
Yes, indeed.
How does that workflow mm-hmm. go, where you're constantly recording, you're constantly shooting what's going on, there's hours and hours and hours of footage, and then paring that down into a workable half hour, 1 hour show? That's an interesting workflow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. I mean, for me and for Ghost Adventures, and I've been on the show for years now, and grown very close. Our executive producer on Sympathy for the Shark is Zach Bagans, also the creator, host, executive producer of Ghost Adventures. And what we do is we actually end up watching all of the investigation footage together, along with the other creator, Nick Groff, and we create like an outline based on that, based on around where the evidence, where the paranormal evidence is. So we have like, a kind of a structure that's broken down through that way of, obviously the show focuses around the evidence. So that's kind of the outlines, and you're watching and you're picking out, puts the story together. And creating an outline out of that, boiling it down.
So is it kind of like in documentary, where you're shooting and shooting and shooting, and over the course of the time of shooting, the story starts to present itself, and that's when you start to cut for that story, as far as each episode goes? Or is it just you pretty much know? Obviously, if you're doing Ghost Adventures, you know where you're going, you mm-hmm. know what the story is.
Right.
I'm just really intrigued by, what maybe 5% of the footage you shoot actually makes it into a show, because you have so much footage. And so,
right. And the difference with, I'm sure it is with other shows. I mean, when you're in the field and you get an idea, the moments that are going to make for a good story, for something interesting or entertaining. So, where those beats are, so you've kind of already got those, in your head. So it's getting to those moments in the most organic and interesting and entertaining way possible. And then also, our show is obviously, much different because you also have the evidence, and so finding out, where the evidence takes place, then those are, your kind of cornerstone tent poles for you to build your scenes around, versus having no idea. But it's everything, every episode is new and has its new things and what you're trying to work around. And then also it's been really really instrumental to what I've learned from that show and working on the show and bringing it over into the narrative fictional, you know, theatrical world.
Okay, Mark, what about in your point now? You shot on Ace of Cakes, which takes place in a working bakery.
Correct.
So how does that work where you're shooting a show and the show is also a business? The show is taking place at a business that actually has to conduct work. So is it – tell me about that as far as – because as far as having to – is there a lot of stop and starts as somebody comes in at the wrong time and – Yeah, how does it work when you're shooting a reality show in a place of business?
That's a great question. That was a very, very interesting show to work on. It was actually my first show where I was officially a camera operator and a director of photography. So it was very exciting, and it was a great show to start with because here you have this working bakery that, other than us installing a lot of lights and putting some ND on windows, we didn't really change anything about their business, the way they conduct themselves. And it's interesting because we cover the show, we did anyway, for 10 seasons, primarily with one camera operator. So I would be in there, and there's 8, 9 people, sometimes 10 people in this bakery at once, all the designers making their individual cakes, the person answering the phone, of course, Duff, the boss, roaming around, working on this and that. So it was difficult to cover for everything, and a problem would erupt, and you'd have to follow it, and you got really good at anticipating, you know, the conversation, knowing how to cover 8 people with one by stuff with one camera is interesting. But we also, because there's so much work being done, if you remember the show, so much of the show is if it's not in an interview, if it's in that reality setting, a lot of transitional stuff is done with time lapses. So I would have my camera for the documentary, getting the content, the conversations, the close-up details out. But then I would have 5 additional cameras that I would set up in the room strategically that would be on time lapses. So you'd want to set it up where you could shoot around the camera if you had to pan over to that person. But also you'd want to be getting the time lapses, the detail work they're doing on the cake, and maybe even frame it in a way that if that person starts talking, you know that camera might be able to capture what they're saying. So it was fun. You were in charge of all these cameras and all these people happening simultaneously, and it absolutely was happening, you know, naturally. We didn't stop and start them. Maybe occasionally you'd ask them to repeat something, but if they drop a cake or they, you know, get in a fight or an argument or they get worried about something, it was all happening in the moment, completely real. So it was exciting. Your day went by in a flash because it was just kind of nonstop controlling all those cameras and following all that story as it happened. Really great show to work on.
And I noticed looking at your website at mjlcinema.com that you shoot with a wide variety of cameras, from the Sony PMW F3 to the Blackmagic Pocket Cinema Camera, which we'll get to in a minute, to the Nikon D800. So you're pretty much a runner and gunner.
And those are my personal cameras, the ones that you lifted off. But just like Devin said, with, you know, I feel like working in this documentary world is you get so many tools that you're able to take into the narrative world. And I'm fortunate enough, as a director of photographer and a director for Authentic, I work very closely with we basically own a lot of our own equipment, and sometimes we have to rent. But with TV reality, it's progressing so quickly. The cameras are getting better and better. They're getting cheaper and cheaper, and you can get these really beautiful cameras that shoot very cinematic stuff to shoot reality TV shows. Sometimes I'm shooting the same camera on a reality TV show as I'm doing for a music video or a short film or a feature, and I've been so lucky to really always try to keep up with the latest technology, because in reality we're always trying to stay, you know, ahead of the other companies to give somebody a shot they've never seen before, you know, be able to shoot in really low light, be able to get really interesting lenses that all the still photography cameras and lenses brought into the mix. So you really have to know all the newest, latest, greatest tech. It's a business. It's changing constantly. So I feel like I'm at a big advantage there.
Now, shooting on the Nikon D800, we all know that that Nikon has had issues with the D800 lately, to the point where they've set aside like $12 million to handle repairs. Have you run into any of those problems with your D800?
I haven't. I'm not the biggest fan of most digital SLRs. They're great for single purpose kind of stuff. And we use the D800 in Sympathy Said the Shark, and the only thing we used it for was mounting it to a bicycle. We were in a very low light situation, and the Blackmagic camera isn't as good in low light as the Nikon, and that was it, one shot. And that's where I use it. I use it if I'm in a very specific situation, low light, or I need a small camera, or I need to go really wide angle, car mount stuff, very specific things. But any digital SLR, to me, you have to sacrifice so much as far as the quality of the image, the compression of the video file, and the ergonomics of the camera. So I don't really like using them unless it's shot that only that camera can get.
Okay, so let's talk about using the Blackmagic Cinema camera. Devin, for your film Sympathy Said the Shark, you chose the Pocket Cinema camera. Take me through that process of choosing the BMPC as your A camera, and what was the motivation behind that?
I guess it goes back to actually, the story itself, because, Sympathy, it's a very contained psychological thriller about this kind of dark and twisted love triangle that unravels over the course of one night. And, the long and the short of it is, I wanted to shoot majority of the film from the explicit POV's point of views of the three main characters. I wanted to make it as kind of visceral and intimate as possible because I knew it was going to be a small movie. So I wanted the, every moment to feel enlarged, to feel like it was really happening to you. So, it seemed like, the best way to kind of do that with a cinematic device was to really put you in the heads of the characters. And then what happens is each time it changes POVs, when we jump to one character to the other, there's an overlap in time. We go back in time just a little bit where you see or you hear something that you missed from the other character's perspective. And this new information, this clue or something, it hopefully changes your whole perspective on what you think is happening tonight, who you think is good, who you think is bad, as happens in reality. Every new kind of piece of information changes your opinion about a situation. So what happened was, how can we do this? I wrote it into the script, but then it became a time of how can we physically shoot this and make it work? And that was, all new ground. That was going to be something more or less experimental for us to figure out. So, the best idea it seems to be would be to build a POV rig, some kind of helmet rig, so that the actor or the operator could actually wear it and have the most mobility of using their body, their hands, their legs. They can walk around and they can actually interact with each other with the least amount of obstruction. And so bringing us to that, Mark and I started discussing this, the rig and the capabilities, what we would have to do to build it, and in researching what kind of cameras. And actually, and Mark came across the Blackmagic Pocket camera. He came up with a list of a few possibilities, and that was among them, even though the camera had not even been released yet. And I don't know if, Mark, you want to talk about that being a part of, the cameras you were looking at and why?
Sure, yeah. I feel like we had a very short list of what cameras could do what Devin wanted. And I knew he wanted to mimic human vision to a certain extent. I mean, it really is POV, so we needed it to look like that. So I feel like that ruled out some small cameras like a GoPro or some of those very specific tiny little cameras that are good for little shots. But if you're shooting an entire film, just don't allow you to have as much control over the image and have a real professional image. So we ruled out that. So that left kind of digital SLRs, which, as I said before, I'm not the biggest fan of, even though I own one. Some of these small Micro Four Thirds mirrorless cameras that have been coming out. And the big like front runners were the GH2. The GH3 was just being released, I think. And I heard a lot of good things about the GH2. So we were looking at those cameras. And then the Blackmagic seemed like kind of the magic bullet because it's really, really small. And it's one of the few cameras out of all of those that actually shoots in a really robust codec. It shoots in ProRes 442 HQ, or you can shoot in its RAW. And so that was a big draw to me, is I knew we were going to be running around a house that would be lit largely by practicals. Obviously, there was other lights, and we'd have lighting cues, and there was more going on. But the people were running around this house, and so the environment was not as like controlled as maybe you would like to be as a director of photography. So it had to be a camera that was flexible. It could overexpose a little, it could underexpose a little, and we could work with the image in post. And so that was a big thing there with the codec. The other big thing actually turned out to be the other great thing about the fact that we chose the Blackmagic camera was based on the size of its sensor. I was worried about using a 7D, a 5D, even a 1DS with a new digital SLR. The sensor is so big that your depth of field is so shallow that it means that pulling focus is very difficult, especially when you're running around the room in somebody's POV. And it doesn't look like it's been envisioned. People, you know, we don't look like on a digital SLR, on a full frame 35 millimeter camera, our vision doesn't look like shooting at a F2. That's too shallow. Our vision looks more like shooting at F8, F11, where more is in focus. And I knew we would not be able to get the light levels we needed to be able to shoot at F8, F11 inside a house at night with practicals. So on the Pocket Cinema camera, it's a 16 millimeter sensor, which means there's much more depth of field. We were able to shoot on beautiful little cine lenses that have just been coming out from different makers like Voigtlander and Magic SLR. And I was able to shoot at an F2, so I had great low light capabilities of the camera, but a lot more was in focus. It looked so much more like human vision. And even though I had a first AC pulling focus the whole time, he was really able to keep everything in focus. It looked cinematic, but it also looked like the human eye. So it's strange to say, but I actually, even now I say, I don't think there's another camera we could have shot on this accomplished everything we needed to get as far as small, looks like the human eye, but has a very cinematic look to it.
And let's not forget, it's under $1,000.
And bonus, it's under $1,000. And the camera was so new that we were worried about hiccups. So Devin actually bought two cameras so that we could have a backup. I mean, it's only $1,000. That was huge. Yeah. Great bonus.
Isn't that kind of nice? Is that you can have you can have multi cameras for under $2,000? It's crazy.
It's great. Yeah. It's
now you mentioned you shot on ProRes and on RAW together.
No, we decided to shoot ProRes.
You shot on ProRes, so you avoided the whole RAW workflow altogether. And then
because, like I mentioned, it came out, the firmware upgrade came out just, you know, a couple of weeks before we started production. So we were afraid of maybe running into hiccups. And then also, you know, we didn't want to be, because we shot a feature in 14 days, you know, so we were burning in two of those days, 12 of them were the principal location. So we were shooting on average 8.5 pages a day. Which, you know, people familiar with with shooting.
That's
know.
A lot.
Yeah, exactly. That is a lot. That is a big bite to take off and to attempt. And so we knew we were going to have to be moving really, really fast. And so we didn't want to be, you know, swapping out SD cards nonstop. We wouldn't have time to stop down. So that was actually another factor of shooting ProRes versus RAW was that we, you know, for just time's sake of making sure we could get everything, was to not be stopping down as much and keeping the cards and the camera.
And you went in post-production, you color graded with, did you color grade with DaVinci?
Yes. Yeah. I actually learned DaVinci in order to color the film.
You on the job training, eh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the guys over at Terry and the guys over at Blackmagic have been really great, really supportive of the film and what we've been trying to do. You know, Zach, our EP, you know, called them up and told them kind of what we were doing with the film and the rigs and the filming. They saw something innovative, you know, that we were doing and using their camera for, and they've been really supportive. And you know, they hooked me up with Resolve, and you know, I've colored other of our projects, you know, in post, just using Apple Color and so on. So I'm somewhat familiar, but yeah, DaVinci was, you know, a whole new world, and it's great. I mean, I think the best way to do things is, you know, as you put it, on the job training, to just get in and forcing yourself to make decisions and figure things out. And it was beautiful. I mean, I think the program was amazing.
Okay, Mark, what were some of the lessons that you took away from using the Blackmagic Pocket Cinema Camera on Sympathy Said Shark? What did you learn from it?
I feel like I learned a new way of filmmaking. Before doing these long takes, these POV shots, one thing I don't know if you has been explained to you yet is the way Devin's script works is you sit in somebody's POV for quite a few pages. And we were able to hide cut points here and there, but we were shooting sometimes very long takes, 5-minute takes, where the actors need to know a lot of dialogue, just tricky blocking where we were running around from room to room to room as people were getting in arguments and chasing each other around. And I was able to really take away a whole new type of filmmaking. Normally it's, all right, let's start with our wide. Let's do all our coverage from this side. Let's do all our coverage from this side. Let's get the reverse. Let's get our inserts. You shoot more to have a more concise schedule, have the least amount of lighting changes, the least amount of setups, the quickest repos. And the actors have to, adapt to that. They know they might have to read just this one line of dialogue from this shot and just this line and get into just that specific emotion. Whereas we were shooting the project basically linearly, which is great for the actors. Mm-hmm. And we were doing these long takes where they really got to get into the scene, and it felt like you were part of theater. And because I, for 95% of the shots, was actually wearing the helmet cam, I was basically pretending to be one of these characters.
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture of the helmet cam right now. This is quite a contraption.
It is. And I mean, so it was a challenge for the actors to look at it, but it was also a challenge for me because now I had to be part DP, part actor. I had to remember the blocking. I had to use my hands to get my hands in the shot. And it really got me so much more involved in the story, in the characters, in the actors that I've ever been before, because I was right there. The actors are looking through the lens at my eyes. And it was so engaging that when we would shoot some scenes, Devin wanted to do flashbacks that were in a more standard type of cinematography, no POV. And when we would shoot those scenes, it was like we were on another planet. All of us had to switch gears and remember what traditional filmmaking feels like. And what I took away is a whole new approach to filmmaking that really, I think, is it's amazing for the actors. And for that, I think it's amazing for the story. I think people are going to get really drawn in to these performances. The acting was just unbelievable because I think of how much freedom the actors had to just explore the scene.
And Devin, what were your takeaways? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. Mark, you know, hit on a lot of them there because, we were in it together. And there's nothing I've ever learned more from in a singular experience than this film, you know, cinematically. Like you said, it was a whole new way of filmmaking, you know, that we were going about it. And, you know, I believe, you know, not only does it when you watch it, it is a unique experience, you know, to see a film this way. But and for us to make it, it was equally as new and refreshing. And you know, that was a huge thing, was these long takes, because it was the first time I'd ever really work this way, you know, as a director. And like Mark said, you know, usually, yeah, you're going to be going from your wide shots, moving in, you know, doing your coverage to your close-ups and so on and so on. But, you know, I really wanted you to feel like you were these characters. So it was really going for these long 5 minute takes, which is, you know, in a, you know, if you watch, go ahead and watch a film these days, and you will rarely, if ever, in watching a film, see a take that goes more than 10 seconds, you know, these days. If not less before we're cutting. So we were going after these really long blocked out shots. And what was really amazing was the organic growth of a shot as we were blocking it out. And,
yeah,
you know, like Mark said, he was right there. He was, you know, he was as if one of the actors as well. And we're going through it. And we would do our first rehearsal to the final take that we're like, okay, we got it. You know, it was like seeing the evolution of man, you know, like the first rehearsal, we'd be like, okay, let's do this scene. It's 5 minutes, you know, this conversation between, you know, our three main characters. And they would just be standing there in like the room. And they would go through the scene, and at the end of the scene, I would have this kind of just this weird sinking feeling in my gut, because it was so dead, you know, it was so stagnant, you know, because we were just sitting there reading through five pages in a room, and I would get this kind of nervous anxiety inside that I would have to fight to hide from everyone, because that's the last thing any actors want to feel, is the anxiety coming from the director, you know, any concern. So I'm fighting that, and then we would all find it together and be like, okay, so what if, as you're doing this, because you're delivering this line and you're feeling this way towards this character, you're moving over here, you know, and you're coming over here. And then at this point, you guys are switching places because you're chasing after him and you're trying to get this from him. And it became this whole, it was like a dance. It was like, you know, we're orchestrating this dance. And then Mark is also orchestrating it with the lighting, because he is very specific, you know, even though we're using these practicals, he was using them to create very distinct looks and these pools of light in certain areas. So it was like, okay, well, this line, you know, you're feeling this way towards the character. So why don't you hit this mark under this light so that it's very top lit and it's very kind of intimidating the way you're looking. And then you'll transition over in this section, and then he'll follow you into the room. And so by the end of all this, this is progressing over every rehearsal. And then even as we're shooting, through every take, we're adding new elements, and it's just the smallest things, because of the POV, you know, rig and the way we're shooting, even the smallest things, like, hey, in your POV, you're going to look down at your bloody knuckles at this point, you know, and then look up, and just those smallest things, because of how we're shooting, it becomes really poignant in visually when you're watching it. And so by the end, it's like, it was like night and day, and it was like, wow, we finally, you could feel it in the room, like, wow, you just went on a roller coaster from the final thing from the beginning when we're just standing around talking. So that was something. So learning that whole new technique, and you really felt it, you know, versus doing a lot of coverage that I would take. And because, you know, I edited the film, and I've been editing for a long time, that's one of my, you know, my background, is that I know what coverage we need to make a scene, you know, so that I'm not going to end up in the edit bay and be like, oh shit, we should have got that shot. How am I going to cut these two shots together? I need a cutaway. I need something this from this angle. So going in it, so is usually versus having something and doing a very cutty scene, is very different going in and trying to create that kinetic energy that you do in post by just cutting up between shot to shot to shot to create this movement, to create this energy in a picture. Instead, we were doing that on set within the blocking. And the way the characters were moving, we were trying to create that kinetic energy where you don't even notice that the camera hasn't changed position for almost 5 minutes.
If you were using another camera, like the F3, for instance, obviously you wouldn't be able to do the helmet POVs, but would it have changed the entire dynamic of the film? Did the choice of the pocket cinema camera pretty much free you up to choose what you envisioned? Or, I mean, do you see where I'm going with that?
Oh, absolutely. Devin was doing a lot of research, and there's been plenty of other movies that have shot POV. We watched one that was interesting for me from the director of photography perspective, because they really shot it, you could tell, on a larger camera. It was probably a lot of steady cam, and there was even a lot of tripod where the camera would pan around. You'd see people's hands creep into the foreground and whatnot, but they really shot it very close to how you would shoot something else and on a larger camera. Maybe that was just a stylistic choice, maybe smaller cameras that they were confident didn't exist when they made the film. I knew that was going to be impossible. Devin, I mean, from the very beginning, Devin wanted, you know, there were fight scenes where the camera is being worn by one of the actors. I had to grapple with, you know, two of the actors in two different, or three actors in three different fight scenes, mm-hmm. where we're rolling around on the ground and the camera is attached to my face basically. And it's looking right up at the other guy as he's trying to, you know, wring my neck, and he's throwing punches at me. If we had a big camera there, it would have been physically impossible to do that. The camera is literally sitting there in the middle of two people fighting, and there's no other way to do it than with the rig that we created.
So do you think from the perspective of filmmakers looking for a camera to use to learn their craft, that the pocket cinema camera, obviously because of its price point, but because of everything else it brings to the party, is that a good option for someone just starting out, as opposed to going with a DSLR or a, you know, or basic video camera?
Yeah, I think it's a great option. I mean, because it also it also looks very cinematic, the pocket camera, compared to other cameras in its realm. So I think for not even getting the low price, but you are getting that cinematic, that intangible cinematic quality, that look, which I think is a huge plus.
I totally agree. And I think that if you're a beginner, I think the most important thing is to just shoot. And I think the best camera mm-hmm. is the one that you can afford, the one you can borrow from a friend, any camera. And, the advantage to the pocket camera is it is affordable. It does happen to also look very professional, but because it is so small, it really allows a first-time filmmaker to get really creative, to place that tiny mm-hmm. little camera in places that you can't put a larger camera. So not only is it cheap, but mm-hmm. I think it allows you to really get crazy with your imagination too.
So what's next?
What's next? Well, we just finished post less than 2 weeks ago on Sympathy, and, you know, we just started going off to the festivals, and, you know, we've got a really, really great feeling that it's, you know, it's going to find a home and do very well on the festival circuit, fingers crossed. So we're actually right now doing the waiting game right now. And we're just crossing our fingers. Hopefully we'll find out soon. And that'll see, you know, the path of the film. But everybody, the whole team, you know, Zach Vagans, he's super excited with how the film turned out, and he's eager to make the next one. So as of right now, everybody who was involved, you know, in our core team did such a phenomenal job. Our crew in cast and everybody in our, you know, our EPs and everybody are so happy. They're pretty much ready to do the next one. So working on a couple scripts and figuring out what would be the best, you know, next step from the film. But now we've, you know, put our first feature in our belt, and it's time to do the next one.
And as you compare the two, obviously, I'm imagining that both of you would say that shooting a feature is far, far better than going on reality.
It's more rewarding, for sure. I mean, I feel fortunate as a director of photography that I usually can find something to get excited about in almost any reality TV show, because my job is to make it look as good as I can, and I can always get excited about that. But there's something different about making a feature. We had night shoots, 12, 13 hour days, night shoots, and 6 days in a row. And I could have done 18 hour days, 20 days in a row, because it was so fun. It was just such you get such a high from making a feature that you really care about, that it doesn't feel like work at all. And so that, yeah, there's not much in this world that compares to that. So it's a little tough to go back to reality TV, but hopefully we'll, you know, we're not going to stop making films. So we're just going to keep going on to the next one for sure.
All right, Mark. Now the real hard hitting question. What's Duff Goldman really like?
Duff Goldman. He's great.
He strikes me as being kind of a madman.
He's a little bit of crazy guy. He likes to snowboard. He likes motorcycles. So he likes to do dangerous things. He likes excitement. But he's as much of a big teddy bear as you'd expect. He takes care of his friends. He's always been more interested in having a business that can employ 15 of his friends rather than, you know, worrying about getting rich quick. He's got a huge heart.
He's kind of gone Hollywood now, though. Didn't he move out to LA now? Because I know he's running the Cape Place down in Hollywood.
And then, he sure did. And that just to show like the kind of guy is, that thing was all about getting kids involved. He's got like baking classes, and he's got really fun ways for kids to bake cakes. But yeah, he moved out here to expand the empire. I think he liked the weather a little bit better than Baltimore, and he decided to stay. but he's doing some great stuff out here for sure.
Devin Lawrence, Mark LaFleur, thank you for joining us on Dottle Talks Technology.
All right. Thank you.
James.
You've been listening to Dottle Talks Technology. For more information, visit our website at www.news.dottleme.com. Got a question or comment? You can drop me a line at james@dottleme.com. You can like us on Facebook and also subscribe and leave us feedback on iTunes. Dottle Talks Technology is a copyrighted podcast from Dottle News. Thanks for listening.